This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Are you a professional? How can you tell? What does that word even mean? One hint, it apparently evolves from something people did in public hundreds of years ago when they felt the need to, well, profess something. One of our favorite historians is here to tell us more. Peter Norton usually talks with us about the history of culture and technology, and this is related, but in the hour ahead, Dr. Norton's going to take us back in time to search out meaning for more than just one word. If he's right, once we better understand where the idea of professional comes from, we might just see our chosen field of work in a whole new light. Willing to risk feeling inspired to reach even harder for your dreams? The conversation begins right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. And here are some of my questions. How satisfied are you with the kind of work you are doing? Is there a story about how you got there? Was there struggle involved? Did someone ever tell you, oh, you'd never be any good at that? Your answers may all be relevant as we seek understanding on one primary issue today. What does it mean to be a professional? If you've got thoughts about that, stories to share, or questions of your own, please do call in at 888-967-2825. Here to help, one of our all-time favorite cultural historians, Peter Norton. Dr. Norton, great to see you back in the Insight Studio.
It's so nice to see you, Tom.
Well, Peter, I understand that you teach your students to see the term professional in a whole different way. And you actually get them thinking about the Middle Ages in order to help with that process. So I want to ask you about that in a few moments, but I was hoping we could start with the story you tell about the lion in the zoo.
Yeah, sure. I think this is a good way to start to look at it. So listeners who can remember zoos a few decades ago, like you and me, for example, will remember a time when in a typical zoo, you might see a lion behind bars in some sort of cage, pacing back and forth or lying listlessly on the ground. The lion was well fed, had good medical attention, but was, you know, it didn't take an expert to see that the lion was miserable. And yet the lion's life was incredibly easy. A slab of delicious prime rib would be thrown in every few hours. And, you know, presumably the lion ought to be happy. The lion's got everything he needs, medical attention, food, and so on. But the lion was obviously miserable. And if you go to a zoo now or any time in the last few decades, it's likely you're going to see a much happier animal, and this lion is likely to be in a pen that is more like a natural environment. And yet this lion's actually working a lot harder. When they feed a lion today, they're likely to make it a real challenge. The zoo professionals call this enrichment. So they'll hide the meat, or they'll, you know, tuck it inside a hollow log, or they'll make it up, put it up in a high tree, and the lion will have to climb. And strangely, you know, the lion's a lot happier. And I say strangely because I think we all grew up hearing something about how the way you get effort out of people is you pay them, and everybody's trying to minimize effort. And you have to sort of police your workers if you're a boss, because nobody really wants to exert any effort.
And the life of Riley is to be the equivalent of the old-time lion, where all of your needs were met and there's no effort on your part.
In theory, at least. I mean, I think it's a defective theory, but that's the idea. You know, you want the maximum of comforts and ease. It's as if, it's maybe a weird analogy, but if you think of a hammer living life by those terms, it would be like it would never want to hammer nails. It would just want to lie around. And yet, if it's not too much of a leap of imagination to think of a hammer as a being, I think the hammer is going to be happier hammering nails. And if somebody will pay it to hammer nails, so much the better, but it's going to hammer them anyway. Same thing with the lion. You look at the lion, you can see, like a hammer, what it was made to do. It has claws, it has teeth, it has muscles, it has speed. And if it gets to use those gifts, it's in its element and it's thriving. And I think people are like that too. It's just that we can't always see their gifts. You know, you can see the lion's claws, you can see the lion's teeth, you can see the lion's muscles. You can't see some of the gifts that people have, and they can't always see them themselves. We hope that at some point in their life they discover them, and then they can have the same kind of thriving happiness that the lion has.
So it sounds, Peter Norton, like we're talking about having a calling, having a purpose, and the lion's purpose is to hunt, is to search, is to put effort into finding food.
Right, yeah, and the effort becomes a completely different kind of thing. It becomes a source of satisfaction.
So our overarching question today is, what does it mean to be a professional? And my guess is there's a link between the story of the lion exercising its sense of purpose and what the historical meaning of the term professional is.
Yeah, I think this the history of the term is really useful because I think it offers us a path to a more satisfying work life, maybe without even changing jobs. If the job's unsatisfactory, there may even be a way to align it with this. But, you know, as I said with the lion, it's clear what the lion was meant to do. It's not always so clear what a person was meant to do because the person's gifts are usually invisible. You know, unless we're talking about an athlete, a sumo wrestler who's clearly physically gifted for the job or something like that. But with people, it's different. And here's where this concept is useful. So I mean, when we hear the word professional, it's likely that it's going to mean a certain kind of career person, like a doctor or a lawyer, ordained clergy, or it might mean a professional athlete or actor. Sometimes people use the word professional to mean a certain way of appearing and showing up on time at work and following directions, and we call that professional. None of those have much to do with the original sense. So to get to your question finally, in the Middle Ages, there was a notion that while most people were born to be peasants or serfs, some lucky ones got to be lords, there were merchants and fishermen and tradesmen, certain select people would be called to serve God. And they would get something called a call, which was some sort of message. Sometimes even it would sound like a voice speaking to them, saying, come and serve the Lord. And this person at that point was not a professional, but had received a vocation, which is just means a call. And so there was a second step that was necessary, and that was to answer the call. And in answering the call, you made a public declaration of commitment to answer it. And that public declaration was called a profession. And that's the first use of the word in English, was as the answer to a call from God.
So I professed to the public what my calling was.
Yeah, you took a vow. You said I think it's analogous to a wedding vow. It's a public declaration of a solemn commitment that's based on something profound. And in the case of a marriage, it's a profound commitment to another person. In the case of this vocation, it's a commitment to answer this call from God.
So it sounds like, historian Peter Norton, that if we were to feel more connected to the original understanding of this term profession or professional, that we would not necessarily automatically assume that somebody that is a doctor or somebody that's a lawyer or somebody that's an paid athlete would be a professional. It depends on kind of the level of commitment they have to that work, and also people in a whole bunch of other fields could be professionals depending on their commitment.
Yeah, so about the doctor or lawyer or athlete, I mean, they definitely are professionals by certain definitions, but not necessarily in the original sense, right? And on the other hand, like you said, if you have a calling to do what you're doing, and that by that I mean a sort of profound commitment that comes from some message that you received, some intuition, some insight that you received, then I think you are a professional by the essential meaning of the original word, which is that you're answering a call. And I think most people get those sorts of intuitions in their life. It's not always easy to answer them, and the answer is as necessary as the call. The call without an answer doesn't make you a professional. It's the call with the answer that makes you a professional by the original sense.
Culture and technology historian Peter Norton is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And to you listening, I have all kinds of personal and intrusive questions for you today. And if you're willing to respond, we are at 888-WMRA-TALK. So here's a few. Do you know your purpose? If so, how'd you find it? If not, what are you doing to look? And how closely related is your current field of work to what you think your purpose is? In all numbers, our call-in line is 888-967-2825. And Dr. Norton, I understand that you have several favorite examples. One of them is a guy by the name, and this is a man, even though his first name is Pearl. Pearl Fryer?
Yes. So I'm a kind of person that likes to understand abstract theoretical stuff through real examples. And so I'm always looking for these real examples, and I find them very useful in class. Students really get it when they see real examples. And so I'm looking around for people who aren't considered professional by the doctor lawyer type definition, or the professional athlete, or even necessarily by the workplace, you dress right and show up on time definition of professional. In class, I call this the fourth definition, even though really chronologically it's the first. So yeah, you refer to one of my favorite examples, a man named Pearl Fryer, and I didn't discover him. I discovered him through the hard work of a documentary filmmaker who made a wonderful documentary film called A Man Called Pearl. Pearl Fryer is about 70 years old, and he lives in South Carolina in a very small town named Bishopville. And this was a man who didn't answer his call, his vocation, for decades. And by the normal social standards, this made him more admirable because he very dutifully and in a disciplined manner went to work, worked hard at a job that wasn't satisfying to him but paid bills.
He was like a factory worker of some kind?
He worked in an aluminum can factory for about 30, 40 years in South Carolina. But he kept getting this call, and I think he ignored it for a long time, but finally he acted on it, and it took the form of a kind of attraction to the waste pile next to a garden supply store, and they would discard their old hedges and plants, and they were in a big pile next to the store, and he felt like he could do something with them. He wasn't sure what he could do, and he finally got up the nerve to ask the garden shop if they minded if he saved a few of these things, and they said, "Oh, you're doing us a favor, they're junk." So he would take them home, and he planted them, and he nursed them back to health, and they began to thrive, even though he wasn't trained in this kind of gardening. And then he began to train these bushes into certain shapes and to trim them into certain shapes. And before long, people were coming from all around to see Pearl Fryer's topiary garden of decorative hedges. And it became a profession for him.
A man answering his call.
Exactly.
We actually have some pictures of that on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. We'll tell you more about where you can find more pictures of Pearl Fryer's success at answering his call, but we'd love to hear your stories as well when we return in just about 1 minute. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Cultural historian Peter Norton, our guest. The question of what is a professional, our focus. And we have an example that Dr. Norton is going to explain to us in a few moments. But first, we're going to play a piece of tape so you can kind of guess what the point is here.
The rest, because I've had five flights today, and I just cannot do the regular boring announcement again. Otherwise, I'm going to put myself to sleep. So, you guys with me?
Yeah.
All right. So, give me a stomp, clap, stomp, clap. Come on, stomp, clap, stomp, clap. Stay on beat there. There you go. Keep that going. This is flight 372 on SWA. The flight attendants on board serving you today. Teresa in the middle, David in the back. My name is David, and I'm here to tell you that. Shortly after takeoff, first things first, there's soft drinks and coffee to quench your thirst. But if you want another kind of drink, then just holler. Alcoholic beverages will be $4. If a Monster energy drink is your plan, that'll be $3, and you get the whole can. We won't take your cash, you gotta pay with plastic. If you have a coupon, then that's fantastic. We know you're ready to get to new places. Open up the bins, put away your suitcases. Carry-on items go under the seat in front of you, so none of you have things by your feet. If you have a seat on a roll with the...
Okay, historian Peter Norton, tell us who that is and what he has to do with the topic we're discussing today.
Well, I mentioned that I love examples of real people, and here's one. This man's name is David Holmes. He's a flight attendant for Southwest Airlines. And what you heard was from a safety announcement that went viral on YouTube a couple of years ago. And I love this example because it's useful in a number of ways. One is, you heard at the very beginning of this clip, David Holmes saying, "I'm just too tired to deliver this in the normal way." And I'm thinking to myself, well, Mr. Holmes, it actually takes a lot more work to deliver it as a rap. For one thing, he had to spend a couple of minutes training the passengers to give him the beat and the rhythm that he needed. For another thing, he had to come up with this rap himself. For a third, he had to memorize it and so on. And it's just a lot harder, I think, to deliver a rap than to just say the memorized script. And I think that tells us something about, it reminds me of the lion. The lion has to work harder to get the meat, but the lion's happier because he's doing what he's meant to do. And David Holmes, same thing. He finds he's getting energy out of this. There's a wonderful psychology professor at Claremont College in California. His name is impossible for an American to say because he's from Hungary. It's Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi. And I'm sure I butchered it. But this guy wrote a best-selling book called Flow. And he's explaining a psychology phenomenon, which is that when somebody's doing something they're really good at and they get engrossed in it, time and space disappears. They're working really hard, but they're not getting tired because they're getting energy out of what they're doing. And David Holmes is getting energy out of delivering this safety announcement. There's one other thing I love about this example, and it came from right before your audio clip began. He says to the passengers, "Some of us flight attendants sing, some of us tell jokes, some of us just stand there and look beautiful. I can do none of those things." And he's a perfectly beautiful man. He should appreciate himself a little better. But what he then says is just beautiful. He says, "Here's something I can do." And in those few words, he's expressing in plain English the whole concept of a profession. It's something you can do. It's something you're called to do. And it's a wonderful rebuttal, I think, to our sort of usual way of thinking about gifted people. I'm going to try a little test on you, and we didn't practice this off air or anything.
Can you hold the test?
Yes, I'll hold
the
test.
I'm not trying to get out of it, but Aziz in Stanton has been holding on for quite a
please.
While.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to make him, I think it's a him, hold all that much longer So, Aziz, thank you for your patience. You're now on the air with your question or comment for historian Peter Norton, please.
Yes, hello. I am a him. I have a little bit of something in my throat today. Peter Norton, I would like to thank you for helping me and allowing me to actually go into my calling. I was taking computer classes at community college and discovered that I had a very high aptitude for dealing with the technology, and also I really liked helping other people and helping to get it to work for them. That may not have happened if it were not for the first edition of Norton Utilities back when it was yours. And my very first paying computer gig was to help a professor at the college clean up his hard drive. And I accidentally deleted a subdirectory. The bad news was it was the subdirectory that had all of his PhD research in it. Fortunately, knowing how to use the Norton Utilities, I was able to get back everything that was important to him. But had that not happened, I might have been so discouraged that I would not have followed my my calling to help make technology accessible and productive and working for people.
Wonderful story, Aziz. I'm going to disappoint you right now, though, and it pains me to do it. I'm not the guy who wrote that Norton Utilities. That's a guy who I'd like to say he stole my name, but he's about 20 years older than me. But that does not diminish the wonderful discovery that you made through that experience, and I would not I'm not here to discount that at all. I think that's wonderful, and I'm so glad you shared that example. And I just wish I could take the credit, but I hope you'll have a chance to thank the other Peter Norton. Maybe Tom can have him on as a guest sometime.
Oh, okay.
Well, and Aziz, it sounds like you have no question in your mind that you have found your calling, and you are glad to profess that you have done so.
I am still doing this kind of work many years later.
Fantastic.
So, yes. Aziz, thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
What does it mean to be a professional is the primary question we're looking at this hour. Do you have thoughts about that? A question of your own to ask? On Facebook, you can reach us at WMRA's Virginia Insight. By phone, we're at 888-967-2825. Historian of technology and culture, Peter Norton is our guest. His most recent book is titled Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. It documents the fascinating story of how America became dependent on the automobile and highways as our primary mode of passenger transportation. While that did not occur in most other industrialized societies, that probably doesn't have too much connection with what we're talking about today, but it was his latest book, so I thought I'd mention it. You have a question, or actually a test, that you're going to put me through, Peter.
Yeah, and we haven't rehearsed this, so I'm honestly just interested in what comes to mind when I ask you to think of a genius. Does a picture come to your mind? And if it does, what's the first picture that comes to your mind?
I hate to be so obvious, but I have that picture in my mind of Albert Einstein.
All right. Well, I felt confident asking you this because I ask students this, and they say the same thing with amazing predictability. I tried this as a test on Google Images, too. I went to Google Images and typed in the word genius, and the first few pictures that came up were all of Einstein. And the reason I'm bringing this up right now is I think that prevailing cultural idea that we have today about what a genius is a big barrier to people finding their callings.
Really?
Yes, because this is why I honed in on David Holmes saying, here's something I can do. Because the original concept of genius is that there's something you can do no matter who you are. There is something that you are uniquely capable of doing in a way unlike anybody else. And it's your job in life to find out what that thing is. And the word genius meant that originally. It's a word the ancient Romans used. And to an ancient Roman, your genius was your guardian spirit, who was your source of creativity, who was your problem solver. If you listened to your genius, you would have a successful life. You would have a guide who would show you the solutions to problems and who would be your creative nature. And everybody's genius is different, so your creativity is different. David Holmes has the wisdom to know his genius, and I think his example to other people is to look for and find yours. This concept actually goes back further than ancient Rome to ancient Greece. At Delphi, there's a temple to Apollo, and there was an inscription on it, which was for the wise. And the inscription read, "Know thyself." And if you know yourself, you will know your genius. And if you know your genius, you'll know your profession, or I should say you'll know your vocation. And then you'll have the opportunity, if you have some courage, and it takes some courage, to answer that call with your profession.
You teach your students about this whole different understanding of profession in your work at the School of Engineering at the University of Virginia. We've talked about some of the things in terms of the history of the term and how that can get people thinking differently. But I understand that you go back even further in history. You were just mentioning ancient Greece. Isn't there something about Plato's Republic and a kind of all-important story told there that you think has relevance to our work as professionals today?
Yes, I think there. To start, Plato's Republic is a long and book with many parts, and there's two little parts in it that I find really significant and really helpful for students encountering this concept of the profession. And my students are going to be engineers when they graduate, and engineers are expected to live up to professional standards, but they don't really know what that means when they start. They're used to the concept of an employee being an instructions follower and a dutiful, conscientious executor of other people's plans. And this isn't enough for a professional to be. So to get them thinking about the concept of a professional and the expectations that come with that, I give them two stories from Plato's Republic to read. And the first one is called The Ring of Gyges. And this is the original magic ring story. In this story, a shepherd chances upon a cave, and in the cave he finds a ring next to a corpse, and he puts the ring on and discovers that it gives him the power of invisibility, which he quickly realizes is his opportunity to do whatever he wants, and he indulges all his whims, and he steals freely from whoever he wants to with impunity. And in the Republic, this is a dialogue, of course, and the person speaking this part of the Republic uses this story to make the claim that there is no such thing as ethical conduct. It's just that people will do whatever they can get away with. And this is actually, I think, pretty much the prevailing model of industrial society, where we watch every worker all the time. We expect them to cheat. We have a time clock so that we know when they arrived, because we won't believe them if they tell us they arrived on time, and so on. And I think the concept of a professional suggests a completely different way of looking at life.
So there were two stories. Was there a flip side to this?
Yes. So this story, The Ring of Gyges, is told by Glaucon in the Republic, who is actually Plato's brother. And I get the impression that Plato didn't like his brother very much, because he really dislikes this story. And it's really a setup for a rebuttal that comes a lot later in the Republic, in a very famous story called The Allegory of the Cave. And in short form, The Allegory of the Cave also has a cave, like Gyges has. It takes a little imagination to picture this cave. Plato wants us to imagine a cave where people have lived since birth, and they've just been looking at one wall of the cave, and they don't know that behind them there's a fire that's casting shadows on the wall. In front of the fire, people are passing objects that cast shadows on the wall, and the inhabitants of the cave only see the shadows. They never see the objects casting the shadows, and they think the shadows are reality. So they'll see the shadow of a chair, and they'll call it a chair, and so on. Finally, one of the inhabitants of the cave leaves, is escorted out by an unknown being, sees the surface of the earth, at first thinks he's gone crazy, can't see anything because of the dazzling light, but as he adjusts to life on the surface, he finally realizes that everything he thought was reality before was a shadow, and that what he's finally seen is the real world. And he goes back to the cave to explain the real world to his associates, and they just decide that he's really gone crazy and threaten to kill him if he doesn't shut up. Now, I don't think it's obvious how that story is an answer to the Ring of Gyges, but I think it helps if you think of the things Gyges was taking advantage of, the things he was seeking because of his invisibility. He was essentially trying to satisfy all his appetites. He would steal food, steal merchandise, engage in a certain amount of illicit sexuality. And what Plato is saying through the allegory of the cave is, rather than being freed by the ring, Gyges has enslaved himself to all of the shadows that enslave the inhabitants of the cave. And if he really understood reality, if he listened to his vocation, if he knew what his purpose was, he wouldn't be interested in all those things. He would rather be who he seems to be. I think there's a wonderful line from Cicero that sheds light on this. He says that people should be rather than seem. This has been used sometimes as a slogan, esse quam videri. Esse quam videri means to be rather than to seem. And if you be rather than seem, there's no reason for invisibility anymore. And it's hard work seeming. It's draining. People want to get away from work when they have to seem at work all day and wear a mask at work, so to speak. But if you can be who you are and live in accordance with your purpose, you actually get energy instead of losing energy.
Historian Peter Norton, we're going to hit the break here in a few moments, and I don't know how quickly I can sum up some of what I've heard from you for the sake of people who've only tuned in recently. But let me try. We're looking at the term profession and what we think it means to be a professional. You take us back to the Middle Ages, where when people felt they got a calling, they would go out in public and profess what that calling would be, and that would become their profession. And today you associate that with the idea that real professionals, in fact, are doing what their purpose is, what their calling is. So now, I gotta ask you, how does somebody figure out what their calling is, what their purpose is? And you've got about 60 seconds to think of your answer, because that's how long before we're going to be back.
Okay.
This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Peter Norton is our guest. He's an historian who teaches in the engineering school at the University of Virginia as part of that school's Department of Science, Technology, and Society. In the ethics courses that Dr. Norton occasionally teaches, he encourages students to research the history of what it means to be a professional. That question and the history behind it is much of our focus today. Want to tell me how to figure out what my calling is?
I'll try. So I would begin again with David Holmes, the flight attendant, when he says, here's something I can do. So I would start asking myself, what's something I can do? And I would try to ask that question while turning off all the background noise. I think that thing you can do, if you're hearing it at all, it's going to be a whispered voice. And if somebody's whispering to you while 10 other people are shouting at you, you're not going to hear the whisper. And the 10 other people shouting at you are probably giving you lots of well-meaning, well-intentioned sound, practical advice about what there's a market for, about making sure that you can get a job in it, about it being prestigious and suiting other people's expectations. And a lot of that advice is very practical and valuable and good. But you also need sometimes to turn off those voices and give yourself a chance to hear that whispered voice about what you can do. And I think you'll hear that whispered voice when you pay attention to the thing you're a perfectionist about. I tend to hear people using the word perfectionist as if only some people are perfectionists and others aren't. But my feeling is that everybody's a perfectionist about something. And I would ask myself, what's that thing I'm a perfectionist about? What's something where it really bugs me when it isn't done right? What's that thing that I don't like to entrust others to do for me? I would rather do it myself. What's that thing that I will keep doing for hours, although nobody else I know would ever spend that much time and effort on it? Another useful question is, what's that thing where, while an instruction manual might be helpful, I would never want to be hemmed in by it? If you find a good cook is going to find a recipe very helpful, but they would never want to be ordered to comply with the recipe absolutely, because if they're in their calling as a cook, then they have judgment and intuition and creativity that the recipe can only hinder. And recipes are really helpful when you're not in your calling. When I'm cooking, I need the recipe. I need absolutely, the more detail, the better. But if somebody who has a calling for being a cook is following the recipe, they want it to be a guide rather than a strict instruction manual. And I think practically everybody has got something where at some point the instruction manual is more of a hindrance than a help. And that's, I think, a real clue as well. One other suggestion I would make is start paying attention to excellence in others, because then you'll train yourself to recognize excellence in yourself. And that's a key indication of where your gifts lie.
Can you tell me more about that? An example, perhaps? Or?
Yeah, well, the couple of examples we've mentioned today, like Pearl Fryer and David Holmes, are people where I recognized excellence in them, but long before I did, other people did. And that's why David Holmes' video went viral, is because people recognize excellence in that. And that's why people fill up buses to go and see Pearl Fryer's topiary garden, because they recognize excellence in that. And I think that when people recognize excellence in others and set aside the bogus notion that genius is Albert Einstein but not me, then they're kind of training their receptivity. They're sort of sending up an antenna that can receive indications of their own excellence. And once you can do that, I think you're more likely to hear your calling, hear that vocation come.
Is it possible that part of what could be going on is, if I see a man who's earned his livelihood for decades working as a fairly low-level employee at an aluminum canning factory, making beautiful gardens that now people from around the world come to see, or I see somebody who's been working as a flight attendant for years and finally decides he has to do his job differently, and as I watch him do it, I'm blown away by the excellence involved, that then I might say to myself, hey, if people from these types of walks of life can find excellence for themselves, maybe I can entertain the possibility I could find it for myself?
Absolutely. I'm troubled by some of the conventional uses of the word professional that are so limiting. You're not a professional unless you're a doctor or a lawyer or clergy, or unless you wear a suit and tie, or something like that. People are called to do all kinds of things. Many of them have little social prestige, but huge social importance. And people who can find an alignment between their calling and their work can find a level of satisfaction that's more rewarding than the prestige they may be lacking. On the other hand, they are almost sure to get admiration for what they do. So Pearl Fryer was not looking for admiration when he started his topiary garden, but he got it. And I think people who start to listen to that voice, even if it's not a prestigious calling, are going to get some admiration from people and some gratitude that's going to be very satisfying to them.
So to you on the other side of your radio, you've probably heard the lottery question before, but as we go through this last few minutes of exploration with our guest, historian Peter Norton, I want to ask you a simple version of it. If you suddenly had more money than you could ever spend, whether it came to you from winning the lottery or some other way, but after having all that money, you eventually decided to do some kind of work just because you wanted to, even though you'd never need a paycheck again. What kind of work would you do? And how much different or similar is that work going to be than what you're doing right now? By phone, we're at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Can I have more than one calling, Peter Norton?
I think different people have different answers to that question, but my own feeling is people can express their calling in a lot of different ways. So, sometimes I get the impression that some people think that your calling means you have to have a certain distinct career and no other, but your gifts are likely to be able to express themselves in a lot of different ways. So like the lion's gifts as a hunter can be expressed in the hunting of different animals and different terrains and so on. The gifts a person has can find expression in various ways.
One of the things that we got to at the beginning of this discussion, Dr. Norton, is with the example of the lion in the zoo, that there had to be effort involved as the lion pursued its nature, or it wasn't going to be satisfied. It was going to be miserable. So somebody has a yearning to do something and they think it might be a calling. Does there need to be struggle in order for them to be happy?
I think so. But I mean, we're talking, a lot of struggle is just misery. Some struggle is satisfying. So it's the right struggle. I don't think following the calling is ever easy. Now, there are people who are sort of lucky that they happen to be very good at something that there's a lot of demand for, and there's already prestige connected with it. But I think making your calling your life is inevitably going to be, in some respects at least, a struggle. Just like the lion has to exert himself to find satisfaction in the hunt, I think a person has to exert himself to find satisfaction in pursuing a calling. But the exertion doesn't have to be miserable. The exertion can be satisfying.
It sounds like some of that struggle could be overcoming friends and family telling you, don't do that.
Yeah, I think there's almost inevitably going to be obstacles. They might come from friends and family who disapprove. They might come from a marketplace that's not really got room for what you're called to do. But I think in those obstacles, the person who's following a calling has an advantage. For example, there are certain fields that where there's an oversupply of people already, or where the market is drying up for these sorts of skills. But the people who have a calling for them are likely to still be able to find something because they have an advantage over all their competitors, which is that they actually get energy from doing it. If I had been forced to go to medical school, I would have lost a lot of energy studying things that I didn't want to study. But there are people with a calling for medical school who actually get energy out of the discovery of how you treat a patient and so on. And those people would have had a big advantage over me. And that advantage is a good thing because it means we end up with people who are better suited to what they're doing in their lines of work. It also means it's unfortunate that we sometimes really pressure people to be very disciplined and to do things that aren't suited to them.
Next to Charlottesville. Rich, thanks for calling us here on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for cultural historian Peter Norton.
I was going to comment on your lottery question.
Please do.
Okay. We talked about this in the late 80s, and what I decided I wanted to do was I would associate myself with a local high school or local community college, and I would give away as much money as possible to get kids educated. And I would give this away anonymously. And I would also try and be a father figure to some of these kids who didn't have that advantage.
It sounds like you found, in thinking about this question, some connection to what you feel called to do to help young people who are trying to find their path in life. And the fact that you would want to make it anonymous is a strong signal that this doesn't have anything to do with wanting people's admiration, but rather just with doing that which you feel called to do. And I'm moved by your answer because a lot of people immediately think about how they would indulge all of their fantasies about world travel and fancy houses and cars. And those are people who the Ring of Gyges story is about, but you're out of the cave.
Rich, I'm just curious, this dream adventure, is it in any way connected to what you find yourself doing on a day-to-day basis today?
No, not really. I work in a highly technical profession or vocation.
I'm going to step in there and say that actually a lot of people find expression for their calling outside of work. And I don't think there's anything, I don't think that's any less worthy than people who find expression for their profession in their work. And so perhaps you found an opportunity to help the kids you've imagined helping outside of work, or perhaps in your technical vocation you found expressions for other gifts that you have, because I do think people can have diverse gifts, and then perhaps you have diverse gifts yourself.
Rich, thank you so very much for sharing some time with us here on Virginia Insight. We're almost out of time, so I just want to get to this one other point, if we could, Peter Norton. The idea of people finding a calling and then being able to pursue it. Many people are stuck in jobs that they feel that they have to be in order to support a family or in order to meet basic needs. I have some sense, Peter, that you think even in those kinds of jobs, people might be able to exercise a little bit more of their profession to be, in the terms we've been talking about, more of a professional?
Absolutely. I mean, certainly circumstances can be very tough, and there can be situations where you just have to be disciplined and patient and endure unrewarding work for a long time. I've certainly done some jobs like that myself. But we hope that once in a while we have a boss or a manager who recognizes that there is value for the employer, value in the company, for helping people connect their work to that which satisfies them. Southwest Airlines welcomed David Holmes' creativity. And in doing that, they not only made David Holmes happier, they made their airline customers happier, and they got a viral video that was like a great advertisement for the company. So if you're a boss or a manager, you may benefit your company by giving your employees room to tap into their gifts in their work. On the other hand, if you're an employee and your boss is not like that, I think if you're willing to take a little risk and try to express your creativity at work, if your boss isn't stupid, it's very likely that they'll recognize that this is a real source of value.
You were going to say more.
Yes. Well, you know, I heard the music. And,
yeah, value and give me something else. A source of value and
satisfaction for you, and a way to make your job into your calling, even if it wasn't in the job description.
I hate it when we cut you short. We're going to have to get you back just to make up for that. Our guest has been historian Peter Norton, professor of science, technology, and society in the engineering school at the University of Virginia. He's also author of the book Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City, which has almost nothing to do with what we've been discussing today, but it's such a fascinating read, I thought I ought to mention it. Peter, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Dan Easley, Terry Ward, and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jaspe and Inner Rhythm. You can find postings of Virginia Insight on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. And when you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will find links to more information about the work Dr. Norton is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.